Let's get started this morning. The purpose of this lesson, the theme, the topic, is to talk about our own particular Baptist history, our own church history. And we hold to what we usually call the 1689 Confession of Faith. It's sometimes called the Second London Confession of Faith. This morning, we're going to talk about the First London Confession of Faith, which preceded our Second London Confession of Faith. And this is really the beginning of Reformed Baptists, or particular Baptists. So we are going to be looking at historical matters, and we are in England. In particular, we are in London, and we are in the 1640s. So we are in London in the 1640s, and this is a time to be painfully brief. This is a time when the National Church of England has really, in many ways, lost its power because the Archbishop, William Laud, has been removed. And the king has also been removed, King Charles. He's not yet executed, but he has had a fundamental conflict with Parliament. And so the head of the Church of England and the head of the kingdom, both of these have been pretty much removed, at least from power, if not from life yet at this point in history. So this means that England is in a very turbulent time. Who is going to control the kingdom? Who is going to control the church of the Church of England? These are big questions, big movements, as I said, being painfully brief, summarizing things that really shouldn't be summarized because they're so complicated, but we have to be brief. Our religious forefathers, our theological forefathers, the particular Baptists, really came to a clear identity during this time. The Protestant Reformation had insisted that doctrine and practice be evaluated or reevaluated in light of the scriptures. And so in the Church of England, this led to a reformation of many things. In the Church of England, if you were a parish priest, essentially a pastor, if you were a pastor of your parish, you're a parish priest, some of those parish priests, they began to feel very uncomfortable with giving the Lord's Supper to everyone in their parish. Because they said, many of these people live wicked lives without any conviction of sin or any effort to live in holiness. They just belong to this geographical parish, so they come to this parish church, and I'm their parish minister, so I'm supposed to give them the Lord's Supper. And so this led to, again, summarizing, oversimplifying, this led to things like Puritanism, where the Puritans, although that name was used negatively against them, you had parish priests who wanted the church to be pure and holy according to God's word. And so they would refuse to give the Lord's Supper to just anyone who came to the parish. They would only give it to the godly or the faithful or the saints in their parish. With that kind of thinking being active in the churches and in the literature, it's not hard to see, although we are simplifying, it's not hard to see how the same logic would come to be applied to baptism. Is baptizing all the infants in this parish the right thing to do? Is that the biblical thing to do? And some of those parish priests in England during that time, they began to be convinced, no, we shouldn't be just baptizing the children of everyone in this parish. We should only baptize the children of the faithful or of the believing parents in our parish. So that's one step towards reforming baptism. Some of them also took a step towards saying, actually, when we look at Jesus' command of baptism in Matthew 28, and we look at the apostles' practice in the book of Acts, baptism isn't given to infants. It's given to those who respond to the gospel. It's given to those who profess their faith, etc. So baptism also underwent, for some parish priests and for some parishioners, underwent a further reformation, which led to what we know as credo baptism. Baptism based on profession, credo, I believe, baptism based on profession of faith. But think of it from the perspective of two different people. If you are a parish priest who remains convinced of paedo baptism, baptism of infants, paidos, that's the Greek word for a child, the baptism of children, if you're still convinced of that, and then your parish priest friend starts to baptize not adults, but professing believers, from your perspective as a still convinced paedo-baptist, that looks like they're rebaptizing people. That person was already baptized. You're rebaptizing them, which you shouldn't do. Christians should only ever be baptized once. And so those who began to practice believers' baptism were usually called Anabaptists. Anna meaning again. Rebaptizers. Anabaptists. So the paedo-baptist parish priests would say, "You're Anabaptists." And the problem with this is while the word Anabaptist described what these credo-baptists were doing, the name Anabaptist was associated with all kinds of immorality, wickedness, and heresy from Anabaptists in Germany, especially in Munster. And so those who began to practice credo-baptism kept saying, "No, we're not Anabaptists because we believe we weren't baptized in the first place, so we're not rebaptizing. And we're not Anabaptists because we don't come from these German Anabaptists who did those terrible things and believed those heretical things that are known, that are so associated with the name Anabaptist." But from the position or the perspective of the convinced paedo-baptist, they say it just is Anabaptism. That's just what it is. You are rebaptizing these people. So, which is all to say, there's a great deal of conflict and difference of opinion in the Church of England. And when you take away the archbishop, who's going to control what the parishes look like and what the Church of England looks like? Well, even before the removal of the Archbishop William Laud, there were parish priests who began to separate from the Church of England. And they were known as separatists for the obvious reason that they separated from the Church of England. Instead of one church in the Church of England with all these parish churches, now you have parish churches and separatists meeting in their own meetings, organizing their own churches with their own pastors independently of the Church of England. And again, from the convinced Church of England perspective, this is a big problem. We have people doing whatever they want, organizing their own churches, doing their own baptisms, rebaptizing it. It was quite a conflict. Well, in the 1640s, skipping over a lot of history, by this time, Archbishop is out of the way, and the Church of England is going to be reformed. And so Parliament assembles a large list of divines or theologians in Westminster. And these divines are supposed to reform the Church of England. They're told, go through the 39 Articles and decide what is faithful to the Scriptures and what is not, because you are going to give the Church of England a new confession of faith. You're going to give to the Church of England a new confession of faith, a new directory for public worship, and all sorts of things. So this is the Westminster Assembly, which you hear oftentimes in churches. Parliament, the Parliament of England, that's the House of Lords and the House of Commons, they have called an assembly of divines in Westminster, and they want this assembly of divines to reform the Church of England, give the Church of England a new confession, a new directory for public worship, and other related documents. And so you have in this Westminster Assembly of Presbyterians, you have Congregationalists, you have what we might call somewhat anachronistically Anglicans, those who are more committed to a hierarchical structure of the church with bishops and such things. The Westminster Assembly is made up of different kinds of divines. They don't all believe the same things, and they debate, and they're working through a new confession of faith for the Church of England. If you're a part of the Westminster Assembly or Parliament that has called them, and you're trying to reform what for you is the one Church of England, what is going to be directly antithetical to your purposes? What if you're going this way as the Westminster Assembly and Parliament, what is it that goes completely this way? Well, it's going to be what is, from their perspective, Anabaptists, who have their own separate churches and baptize people based on profession of faith. From the perspective of a Westminster Assemblyman, someone who's separating from the church and rebaptizing people, from your perspective, is destroying your efforts. You're saying, no, look, we've gotten rid of the king, we've gotten rid of the church, the archbishop, we're all moving forward to reform the Church of England. You are weakening our efforts by having your own churches. You're weakening our efforts by practicing Anabaptism. And so the Westminster Assembly, together with Parliament, they wanted to suppress and prevent and stop the practice of Anabaptism, which Anabaptism is this broad category that can mean all sorts of different things. But I want to point out how, from their perspective, something like Anabaptism would seem destructive to the well-being and the progress of the Church of England. It's important to understand it's not just theology versus theology. It's not just opinions versus opinions. It's historical context. Why would they be so upset by separatist churches, Anabaptist churches? One of the reasons is that they were trying to reform the one Church of England and saying, this is our chance, this is the moment, let's do it. And then the Anabaptists they view as antithetical. So in the handout that I've prepared for you, I want you to see what was going on in the historical context that led up to the publication of the first London Confession of Faith of our particular Baptist forefathers. So we see in March of 1644 that Parliament, and what we're going to read here are excerpts from the records of Parliament and the Westminster Assembly, Parliament began to prepare an ordinance for suppressing the unlawful assembling and meeting together of antinomians and Anabaptists. Why? I've already briefly and hurriedly explained why they would view that as unlawful, unhelpful. No, there should be just the one Church of England, and these unlawful assemblies are getting in the way. They're going in contra of what we are trying to establish. But as far as I can tell from the records, no ordinance was passed at that time. It may have been, and I may have missed it, but I didn't see it. However, later that year, just a few months later, in August, the Westminster Assembly, they bring forward a petition to Parliament, because the Westminster Assembly doesn't have power to do anything, but they advise Parliament. And so the Westminster Assembly, they bring up a petition to prevent the spreading opinions of Anabaptism and Antinomianism with that turbulency that it tends to a division amongst them that join in the owning of this great cause, the reform of the Church of England. Notice again, this is them saying, if we allow Anabaptism to continue, it's going to break into pieces what we are trying to do together in a united manner. It tends to a division, they're saying. But in regard to the unseasonableness of the time, we did forbear. So they had wanted to suppress this, but because it wasn't the right time to do it, they had forborne. They had not yet done it. But now, they're saying in August of 1644, but now we see those men have cast off all affection and are so embittered that it is high time to suppress them. So from the perspective of the Westminster Assembly divines, they're saying the Anabaptists don't want to work with us. They're going to do their own thing. They won't listen. They won't submit. So we just have to suppress them. And then later that month, August 31st, it's ordered that the matter of how to suppress Anabaptism, that it be referred to the Committee of Plundered Ministers to proceed with all such as shall publish the opinions of Anabaptism or Antinomianism. Let me explain this. So in the Westminster Assembly, they had various committees. One of the committees was the Committee for Plundered Ministers. What? Well, you see, pirates had been plundering. No, just kidding. We're simplifying. In the time of William Laud and the bishops having power in the Church of England, Puritan ministers or ministers who didn't agree with everything that was being set forth by the bishops or the archbishop, they often were removed from their livings. They were removed from their parish churches. So they're considered plundered. They and their livings and their goods have essentially been taken away from them. And now that the Westminster Assembly is, in some senses, in power, they have a committee to restore these people and to handle the issue of filling pulpits. The Committee for Plundered Ministers is dealing with stocking the pulpits of the nation in the parish churches. And so Parliament is saying, we as Parliament aren't going to deal with Anabaptist preachers and Anabaptist pastors. We're going to refer that to the Committee of Plundered Ministers, and they can deal with Anabaptist pastors or preachers and such things, those who publish those opinions. So the Westminster Assembly is being granted a degree of authority to handle this. In September of 1644, so the committee gets to work. The Committee for Plundered Ministers gets to work making a list of suggestions which they will give to Parliament in hopes that Parliament will make it law. The Westminster, the Committee for Plundered Ministers, will say, this is how Anabaptism should be suppressed. They'll deliver that to Parliament. If Parliament rubber stamps it, it becomes law against the Anabaptists. 5th September 1644, my brother's birthday. Then this is describing within the Westminster Assembly what was going on. Then were we about to transmit our remedies against Anabaptism and Antinomianism to the Houses. So the Committee for Plundered Ministers is going to give their suggestions to Parliament. But before they do that, it says, when Mr. Philip Nye, in the name of others also, desired to put in his reasons against them, and this cost a large and a hot debate. At last, with much ado, it was put to the question and voted that these remedies should be sent in the afternoon. Remember that Philip Nye is one of the Congregationalists, or one of the Independents. Philip Nye does not believe that a presbytery or a bishop or an archbishop should have ecclesiastical jurisdiction over local churches. Philip Nye, with others like Thomas Goodwin and Jeremiah Burroughs and Samuel Bolton and later John Owen, they were Independents or Congregationalists. And so as Philip Nye sees the Westminster Assembly preparing to suppress Anabaptists, Philip Nye is connected to some degree with the Anabaptists, and he knows that the suppression of them will lead to the suppression of Congregationalists also, at least to some degree. And so Philip Nye is defending, with qualifications, he's defending the Anabaptists, giving his reasons against the Westminster Assembly. No, you should not suppress them for these reasons, and there's all kinds of debate about it. And notice that it's in the name of others. Philip Nye is representing a group, saying you shouldn't suppress them. And when he was asked, when Philip Nye was asked, on whose behalf are you speaking? He said, I desire to be exempted from this. He wouldn't tell. He didn't want to say whom he was representing as he defended Anabaptists, or at least he's not defending Anabaptism, but he's defending their right to assemble and to gather together. So we see that there's internal conflict in the Westminster Assembly about how or whether to suppress separatist congregations and Anabaptists in particular. And one of the remedies that the Committee for Plundered Ministers was going to suggest to Parliament and did suggest to Parliament is here, quoted for you, that all ministers who teach or divulge baptizing of infants to be unlawful be commanded to bring in the grounds and reasons of their opinions in a brief and compendious manner in writing under their hands unto the assembly to be examined according to the word of God. So the Committee for Plundered Ministers is inviting Anabaptists. We will give you an opportunity for you to show us your reasons. We will give you an opportunity to state your reasons. Why do you believe that the baptizing of infants is unlawful? What are your theological grounds for doing so? And then later that month, the committee's advice is presented to Parliament as they had voted and agreed to do. Well, what is published the next month? The First London Confession of Faith is published the next month. So we need to understand that the particular Baptists at that time, which were seven churches, they were seeing there's legislation coming our way that could very well destroy our lives. It would take away our right to assemble. It would, not that they necessarily had a right to assemble at that time, but it would empower the government to, I should just start over. It would make life harder for them, which was already difficult. It would make their lives harder, and there would be new legislation to suppress their meetings. There was actually legislation already in place from the time of Queen Elizabeth, but anyway, they can see the writing on the wall. They've been invited to offer their reasons in a brief manner under their own hands, and so the First London Confession was published with the names of the messengers on behalf of the churches attached to it, and it's a brief, short summary of their faith. The First London Confession of Faith is not a polemic or an argument for credo baptism or against infants baptism. It is rather a declaration of their orthodoxy in the fundamentals of the faith, as we've been talking about in other Sunday school lessons. But notice, it's not a, it's not a coincidence, but it is a coincidence, a coinciding, a coincidence, that the First London Confession is published in October 1644 in the context of the Westminster Assembly trying to deal with Anabaptism. Another reason for this is the fact that Anabaptism is this broad category with all kinds of incredibly negative connotations, and the particular Baptists, they want to show we're not, when they want to show to the Westminster Assembly, what you think of as Anabaptists, that's not us. That's not what we believe, that's not what we practice, and our confession of faith will show that to you. Well, the discussion, remember that Parliament now has the advice of the Committee for Plundered Ministers on how to suppress Anabaptism, and at that point, from November onwards, they discuss it, but they just keep deferring it, and as far as I could tell, it never actually went into any kind of legislation until perhaps later with the Blasphemy Act, but that was short-lived too. So, as far as I can tell, and I could be wrong, what the Committee for Plundered Ministers proposed and intended did not actually come to fruition. And I don't intend to say that the First London Confession caused that or prevented that in any way. It's just all these things are happening at the same time. And our first confession of faith was published as a response to the Westminster Assembly in the context of Parliament and the Westminster Assembly reforming or trying to reform the Church of England. And so what I want to show now is just two brief quotes from the First London Confession, and then some responses to the confession, and then we'll conclude with a few pictures of, we'll conclude with a few pictures just to give you an idea of the, not just the history on a page, but history in pictures. So look with me in the handout at the purpose of the confession, and notice that in the preface, the particular Baptists, the seven churches, they addressed the confession to those that think themselves much wronged if they be not looked upon as the chief worthies of the Church of God and watchmen of the city. They're talking about the Westminster Assembly, and they're saying that the Westminster Assembly is really arrogant. Why should we answer to you? You think that you're the chief worthies of the Church of God, that you preside over the whole land, and if we don't answer to you, then you're upset and you're offended? And they also call them the watchmen of the city because they're describing themselves as the Shulamite from Song of Solomon, who goes out into the city and the watchmen take her veil and hurt her. They're saying that's us. We're the bride of Jesus Christ. You're the watchmen of the city, and you're trying to take off our veil and hurt us. And you're upset because you think yourselves the worthies of the chief worthies of the Church of God, but we're going to anyway humbly present to you our confession of faith so that you know what we believe. And then the second quotation, we've actually read this in a different lesson. They say this in their preface: "We question not, but that it will seem strange to many men that such as we are frequently termed to be, lying under that calumny and black brand of heretics and sowers of division as we do, should presume to appear so publicly as now we have done." Remember, they're called heretics. They're called schismatics, sowers of division. Why would they appear so publicly with their names in a confession of faith? They say, "We have therefore, for the clearing of the truth we profess, to clear it from accusation, briefly published a confession of our faith, as desiring all that fear God seriously to consider whether we have not been slandered in pulpit and in pen by other people." So they're declaring their orthodoxy, they're trying to clear their names from accusation, they're responding to the Westminster Assembly, and therefore to Parliament secondarily. Now, did they just write their confession from scratch? No, most of it is taken from other preceding documents, just like our second London Confession of Faith. And so, briefly, the main sources of the confession's content are the True Confession from 1596, which was a confession of faith published by Henry Ainsworth and London separatists who settled in Amsterdam. Think about the classic story of the founding of America. The pilgrims couldn't practice their faith in England, so they went to Amsterdam. And then they left Amsterdam and they went to Massachusetts, the best state in all of the United States. And everyone who's born there is just the best. Just kidding. And then that's why the pilgrims came to America. There's truth in that. So some of the separatists went from London to Amsterdam and stayed there. And then after the time of Queen Mary, during King James I, they came back to London in hopes that James I would help them reform the Church of England. But no, James took the side of the bishops, and it was a great disappointment, etc. Anyway, the True Confession of 1596 is a Protestant confession from Henry Ainsworth. It was still a Paedo-Baptist group of people, but those separatists is really much of the historical context that led to the particular Baptists. I'm sorry, that was poorly said. Also, the points of difference from the same community, the London, Amsterdam separatists. And then William Ames, The Marrow of Sacred Divinity, it's a large systematic theology which was published in Latin, then Englished in 1642. And so these three documents and a few others are the main sources that the Baptists used to write their Confession of Faith, or to edit their Confession of Faith. So it's not de novo, it's not from nothing, it's not completely new. It's using Protestant and Reformed theology to express orthodoxy and speaking to the Westminster Assembly. Well, we have various responses from Westminster Assemblymen to the Confession of Faith. And we can read those and then get into the brief PowerPoint slides. So Stephen Marshall, a Presbyterian, he said this about the first London Baptist Confession of Faith. He said, "I acknowledge it the most orthodox of any Anabaptist confession that ever I read, although there are sundry heterodox opinions in it. And such a confession of faith as I believe thousands of our new Anabaptists will be far from owning." Stephen Marshall is saying, this is the most orthodox Baptist confession I've ever seen. And he's saying, pretty much the rest of anyone who's called an Anabaptist would not hold to this. It's too orthodox for the Anabaptists. So Stephen Marshall is acknowledging its orthodoxy, its truth, and that the particular Baptists are not like other Anabaptists. They're not like other groups. He says, although there are sundry heterodox opinions in it, because like I said earlier, to a Westminster Presbyterian, credo baptism and congregationalism are destructive to the unity of the church and the project that they're trying to work on. So he still views those as serious errors, but in terms of the fundamentals of the faith, he's saying, I acknowledge it the most orthodox of any Anabaptist confession that ever I read. That's a big statement from a very prominent Presbyterian. Robert Bailey, a Scottish Presbyterian, he said, tell the English Anabaptists now of the doctrine and practice of their fathers in Munster, that's those terrible ones in Germany, and elsewhere. They are ready with passion to deny all affinity, all consanguinity with such monstrous heretics. If you say, you're Anabaptists, the English will say, no, we're not. We're not like them. We're not from them. He says, the furthest they will profess to maintain is but a simple anti-paedobaptism. What is the connection between the particular Baptists and Anabaptists? Well, they both practice credo baptism or anti-paedo baptism. That's all they will acknowledge to have in common with them. Robert Bailey says, we wish that all our questions with that generation of men were come to so narrow an issue. We are loath to force upon any man the errors which he is willing to disallow. So Robert Bailey is saying, with the particular Baptists, all we're really dealing with is their anti-paedo baptism. We wish that's all there was to deal with Anabaptists. But most other Anabaptists have all kinds of other problems and heresies. And then he says, we wish that all these who go under the name of Anabaptists in England were resolved to stand to the articles of that confession without any further progress in error. Saying, I wish that it were the case that this is what Anabaptists believe and that's it. But in his mind, they have to deal with so much more because other people known as Anabaptists believe all kinds of terrible things. So those are fairly charitable responses to the first London Confession of Faith, but not everyone was so charitable. Daniel Featley said this, if, this is like, you should select the word if and increase the font like 20 times, if, it's a big if we give credit to this confession and the preface thereof, those who among us are branded with that title, Anabaptists, are neither heretics nor schismatics, but tender-hearted Christians, upon whom, through false suggestions, the hand of authority fell heavy whilst the hierarchy stood. for they neither teach free will, nor falling away from grace, nor deny original sin, nor disclaim magistracy. And to this purpose they have published this confession. Now, this is where he doesn't follow through with his if. Of which I may truly say they cover a little rat's bane, that's poison, in a great quantity of sugar. So Daniel Featley says, this confession of faith looks nice and sweet, but it's poison. It's poison. So he doesn't give credit to the confession or its preface. And he doesn't agree that they are not heretics, they're not schismatics, but they've simply been punished for their faith under the hierarchy, etc. So Featley, on the one hand, acknowledges all the things they've said, but then basically just says, but it's poison. It's poison wrapped up in sugar. Thomas Edwards, similarly, he talked about the First London Confession, and he said that they don't hold orthodox doctrines as the Reformed churches do. So he's saying they'll say the same things. Their confession states Reformed orthodox teachings, but they mean something different. Thomas Edwards just won't believe. He won't take the particular Baptists at their word. He regards them as insincere. He says, yeah, the words on the page are orthodox, but you don't believe them the same way that Reformed churches do. So you can't win with some people. You publish publicly with your names a confession of faith, and some men say, this is the most orthodox Anabaptist confession I've ever read. Others say, yeah, if we give it credit, but it's actually rat poison in sugar. And Thomas Edwards says, they don't mean what they say. Increase Mather, he said, in England, several Anabaptist congregations emitted confessions of their faith, wherein they professed orthodoxy as to the fundamentals in doctrine, and that they only differed from other churches as to infant baptism. And yet I know not how many of the leaders in these congregations afterwards durst openly strike at the foundation of the true Christian religion. And so Mather is saying, yeah, they had a good confession, but several of their leaders became heretics, and he names a few, which it's true that in a few cases that did happen. But does a few bad apples mean the whole batch is bad? Or that the confession is insincere or unorthodox? No. So this is the original historical context of our first London Confession of Faith, as well as some responses to it by people from that time and from that era. And that gives us a sense of where we come from historically. It's one piece of the pie of explaining where we come from. And that's the first London Confession of Faith. The second London Confession of Faith was published 33 years later. So now I want to show you the Confession of Faith. And since I have this microphone, I can talk with my back turned. 1 LCF, the first London Confession of Faith. And it was published first in the year 1644. Then it was revised and republished in 1646. And revised and republished in 51. Revised and republished in 52. And then the same edition was published in 53 again. So it was printed in 5 different years with 4 different editions where things were either clarified or adjusted in various ways. So it was a document that developed over time. When it came out in 44, men like Stephen Marshall and Robert Bailey, they made some good criticisms on certain points. And so the 46 adjusts in places and becomes more specific and clear in response to some of those responses, redundant. It was a developing document as the particular Baptists clarified and confessed their faith more clearly. Let's go to the next slide. Here is a map of London during this time, a little bit later than this time, but I want to point out, you have the River Thames here, and over in this area, this is Westminster. Westminster Abbey is down here, and the Parliament and, you know, Big Ben would be down here now. It wasn't there then, and now Westminster Bridge would be down here. So this is the city of Westminster and Westminster Abbey, and the Westminster Assembly is meeting in the Westminster Assembly in the Westminster Abbey in Westminster. That's where all the names come from. It's because they met in Westminster, in the city of Westminster. And this is where the government... Well, Whitehall is here with more government offices, but there's government offices. Over in this area, you have a lot of centralized government for the kingdom. And then London proper is over here. This is London proper. The city of London is here. You can see the Tower of London right there and the London Bridge right here. At that time, there was only one bridge across the River Thames, the London Bridge. That's why you see all these boats, watermen. They would just ferry and taxi people across the Thames all the time. It was just one bridge, London Bridge. This right here is St. Paul's. You know, feed the birds, tuppence a bag, Mary Poppins. That's St. Paul's, Westminster Abbey down here, Tower of London. This is the City of London. And the Great Fire of London was here in this area between this main street and the River Thames. So all of this was burned in 1666, essentially. Now, the particular Baptists, their churches tended to be in this eastern part of London, away from the government offices, away from the government, its buildings and such things. They tended to be in the poorer parts of London, towards the east, further away. The closer you get to Westminster and the government center, the fewer particular Baptist churches. And so this gives you a sense of London and Westminster. And down here would be Southwark, where later in time, Benjamin Keach would have his church down here in Horsley Down. Hercules Collins would have his church over here in Wapping. And then the Petty France Church was here. Devonshire Square Church was here, etc. So we'll go to the next. Well, hold on. Before we go to the next slide is going to show. Can you see the red pointer? Okay. The next slide is going to zoom in on a different map, but of this area. So we're going to be looking at just London in the next slide. Okay, so now we're zoomed in. Here's St. Paul's, feed the birds, tuppence a bag. Here's the Tower of London. Here's the River Thames down below. So Westminster would be further this way and then down, etc. This is London proper. And up here is where the Glass House Church was. At the Glass House building, particular Baptist churches met there. That's really where, in the 1640s and 50s, the heart of particular Baptist life was located. And it's actually possible that several particular Baptist churches met in the same building on Sundays. It's kind of a strange thing to think about. But anyway, that's what it is. What it is. Here is All Hallows on the Wall, where Thomas Brooks was married. We mentioned that when Campbell did Thomas Brooks in Sunday school. London Wall is running along here. And so there's, I may have the border a bit off. London Wall is there. That's, you know, really old London is within the walls. And you have gates. You have a gate here, you have a gate here, you have gates around. But by this time, the city had grown out of the London Wall, out of the gates. And the Petty France Church was just on the other side of London Wall, right here. That's Petty France. If you walk less than 5 minutes, you'll get to Devonshire Square, and that's where William Kiffin's church was. And then, of course, Hercules Collins would be out here towards Wapping. And there were other churches in the area. Some met down by the River Thames, but they're in this general area. And now we're going to zoom in even further onto this sort of this square in the next picture. Okay, so here's the Glass House building where particular Baptists met in the early 1640s and 50s. And then the Petty France Church met here in Petty France. That's kind of like little Tokyo, little China. Petty France, Petite France, Little France. It's just a neighborhood in London. And this is Devonshire Square, where off of a little alley from it, behind the square, was the Kiffin's Church. And then when the Petty France Church was evicted from this location because of persecution, they moved up here to Artillery Street by the old Artillery Garden. And that building is still there today. You can go visit it. And Devonshire Square is still there today. You can go visit it. If you come with me to London, we'll do a tour. It's great. But it's really funny to me how you have particular Baptist churches this close to each other. You know, less than a 5 minute walk. You just go, and you're there. But they had plenty of members. You know, you have a couple hundred in each church. So each church was sufficiently stocked to be independent. And you can't, if you put them all in one place, you make it just that much easier to find you, right? While it's illegal to meet. So it was churches like these that were publishing the first London Confession of Faith. It was churches like these that were worried about persecution. It was churches like these that were responding to the Westminster Divines way over in Westminster, the city of Westminster, in Westminster Abbey in the Jerusalem Chamber. Let's go to the next slide. Here's a picture of the first London Confession of Faith. This is at the Huntington Library in San Marino, not very far away. And it was published in 1644 in London. And notice that it's the Confession of Faith of those churches which are commonly, though falsely, called Anabaptists. Every chance they get, they say, "We're not Anabaptists. We're not Anabaptists." Presented to the view of all that fear God, to examine by the touchstone of the word of truth. So compare our confession with the scriptures is what they're asking you to do. As likewise, for the taking off those aspersions which are frequently both in pulpit and print, although unjustly, cast upon them. So you can see, you can kind of see, the first London Confession is short. It's not a book, it's a pamphlet. It's just stitched. It's just pages stitched together. It's not a big bound book, it's a pamphlet. So if you go see it, well, if you see it anywhere, there's different libraries that have copies, it's always just stitched. It's not a published or bound book. Next, please. Here's the 1646 confession. Does it say? Yeah, look, the second impression corrected and enlarged. So they're making it clear. We've edited this. We've corrected things and we've expanded some things. 1646 down here. Seven congregations in London, commonly but unjustly called Anabaptists. Next, please. And then skipping ahead to the fourth edition, fourth impression corrected, 1652, a confession of faith of the several congregations, now we're more than seven, in London as well as in the rest of the country, commonly though unjustly called Anabaptists. And I think there's one, maybe two more. Here's a picture of William Kiffin. He was very much involved in everything we've been talking about. This portrait is at Regent's Park College in Oxford. I took that picture of Billy the Kiff, as I like to call him. And this is his signature from a document during, I think he was in his 50s. This is his signature on his last will and testament when he was quite aged. And this is another one of his signatures, though I'm not sure that he actually signed it. I think someone else signed for him. So this is William Kiffin, one of our Baptist forefathers, one of the most well-known. He was a glover and a leather seller and a merchant and a pastor in Devonshire Square. We saw that the church on the right-hand side of that road, Devonshire Square, he was one of the pastors of that church, one of the leaders of the Baptists in the during the time of the First and Second London Confession. Next slide is Hansard Knowles. This is Hansard Knowles. It says he's aged 93 in this portrait. He lived into his 90s, and we have two signatures. I didn't take that picture, so I'm not responsible for the poor quality of it. But here's his signature or his autograph. And Hansard Knowles also, by the time of the second edition of the First London Confession, so 1646, then his name was on that one, and he got more involved by that time. So William Kiffin was all along. Hansard Knowles came soon after and continued on into the 1690s when he died. So this gives you just something to put in your mind as a visual connection to history. Okay, that's London, that's Westminster. This is where the churches were generally located. Here's some of their specific locations. This is what the confession looked like. This is how they could hand it out as a pamphlet, essentially. These are some of the faces of the men that the Lord has used in our own history. And is there one more slide, Hayden? I don't remember. No, okay. So, we're a little bit late. We'll stop there, but I hope that just helps you connect to our church history. And next week, Matthew Brennan will be here to give a presentation on Ireland. Then Pastor Campbell does the first Sunday in May. And my last Sunday school will be on the second London Confession, a presentation similar to this one, moving on to what is now our current Confession of Faith. So thank you for your attention. If you have questions, you can talk to me now, but I'll end the session.